So organization as client, I feel like this comes up a lot in our EO practice area, right? Most of the time we are representing a nonprofit organization, not the president of the organization, not the board of directors, we represent the organization. So understanding that there are differences there, right? Where maybe what's in the best interest of the organization isn't always what's in the best interest or what's in the interest of the president or a board who may be advocating something that could be potentially harmful to the organization. And we've seen this come up in practice in several different ways. A good example is once did an examination with an organization where the IRS was proposing to revoke their tax-exempt status due to private benefit and annulment issues. Those private benefit and annulment issues were also related into 4958, alleged 4958 transactions for the head of the organization. So now we have a president who maybe is the person who hires you, that's the person you develop a relationship with, but you represent the organization and what's in their best interest. And if something like their exemption is being potentially threatened, you have to really look at, can we represent both sides of this, or do we need to tell the president, you need to go get your own counsel. We can't represent you on this 4958 issue at the same time that we are saying to the organization, you might need to fire that person. You might need to put them on leave. There are actions right there that are just necessarily opposed to one another in order to preserve the organization. So knowing who your client is.
And I think of this as sort of the corollary of the charismatic founder or CEO problem in the fiduciary duties context. So sometimes boards and officers will confuse the identity of the executive or the founder with the identity of the organization, really want to be supporting the executive or the founder. So really reminding them that their duty is to the organization, not to any one individual.
Yeah, and that can come up a lot in issues like sexual harassment or discrimination claims, right? Where somebody who is this very charismatic leader of an organization that you think is tied into the organization's ability to fundraise or a particular advocacy movement is also accused of doing these very awful things. And so once you have that information that these things are happening, where do you go? And I feel like this is an issue that probably in-house counsel has to really struggle with a lot when these things come up of where do you go? If the president of the organization is the one being accused of misconduct in a way that could harm the organization, then under the model rules, it's your responsibility to bring that up to a higher level within the organization and raise those issues there. There are some places where you actually even you can take it further. You can take it to the board, and if the board doesn't take action, you can then take it outside of the organization and become a whistleblower.
Not in California.
But not in California. In California, you go to the board and it stops, right?
It's much more difficult to disclose outside the organization.
And then one of the other places that we sometimes see this conflict between an organization as the client versus who, the employees of the organization or others, is when you're doing an investigation or you're in litigation and you have to now go and interview employees. When you're meeting with these people, so this paragraph F, and dealing with an organization's directors, you have to explain the identity of the client, explain who it is that you're representing, and know who you're dealing with. So if I'm doing an investigation or a litigation and I have to go interview employees for that, I have to make very clear to them that I represent the organization, not them. And you want them to be truthful. You want them to give you the information that you need for your investigation. But they have to know that at the end of the day, you are not their attorney. So if they provide you with information that is problematic for them, it's not your job to step in and protect them from any potential consequences because you're representing the organization.
And the trick here is that if you are not careful, if they reasonably believe that you are their lawyer, you have formed an attorney-client relationship with them, and then you may have a conflict problem.
Exactly, which is not a good thing to have happen. So Circular 230, dealing with the IRS rules, also has similar conflicts of interest requirements that limit your ability to represent two parties where there's going to be sort of this adverse risk between the two entities involved. For that conflict, it's sort of interesting here that everybody has slightly different rules. And so as a best practice at our firm, we adhere to whatever the most conservative rule is in order to ensure that we've sort of satisfied all of the rules. So an example under these conflict of interest rules of that. ABA says if there's a conflict of interest that's a waivable conflict, that you need informed consent and it must be disclosed in writing. I'm licensed in DC. DC is much more permissible than the ABA rules. It says that I just have to give informed consent after full disclosure. I don't actually have to do this in writing. Now, my malpractice insurer wants me to do it in writing, but DC does not require me to do it in writing. Circular 230, though, says that at the time the conflict becomes known, it must be in writing, and that writing must be within 30 days of the time of the conflict being known. So as a best practice for us, if we ensure that it is in writing and within 30 days, which I can't imagine actually waiting a full 30 days, but in writing and within 30 days, we've satisfied the most restrictive rule and we're not in violation of any of our obligations.
And really, I would argue you might be in violation if you didn't do it sooner, because how could you operate with two clients with a known conflict for longer than 30 days?
Right. And like I said, there are other places where you may have additional restrictions placed on you outside of these various ethical rules. Your malpractice insurance may require that you do something in writing, even if the ethics rules don't, or it may require that you do it within a certain time frame or follow a certain procedure.
And that will typically be embodied in whatever your internal firm policies are if you're an outside law firm.